And I'm in love with this good life.
Yes,
we are back at it, brother. Man, I tell you what, this week's going to be a good one because this is a good friend of ours, both of ours. And you know, some of the stuff he's done in the game, you know, he's a little humble. Probably when we pump him up right here, he's not going to know what to do with himself.
Right.
19 years in the show. That's a lot. I played 12. He played 7 more than me. When I got to MLB Network 2, he told me I retired too early. I was like, take it easy over there. I'll bundle you. 162 wins, pretty impressive. Under 380 ERA, 2-time All-Star, 2 World Series rings, and one of those was in pitched Game 7 in 97 World Series. One of the best lefties I think the game's ever seen. I've faced a lot of them, and some of the best. This guy was no doubt one of the best. 1999 playoff game, play-in win, Game 2, 163. We saw one of the nastiest versions of Al Leiter while I was with the Reds. 2-hit shutout to send the Mets to the postseason. Pretty impressive. Has so many unbelievable things done through a no-hitter in 96. We'll get to all this stuff. But let's bring in our good friend, our buddy, Al Leiter. What's up, Al?
Good. I'm good. All right, so here, Chintz, I'm going to direct this to you. Okay. I've always seen, known, and talked to Sean over the years, as you do. You crisscross your baseball career. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea until he came onto the network, and in a playful way, only the way Sean could do it, he's like, Madigan. Like, what? He goes, yeah, that's 163rd game. I had, I think Aaron Boone was at third base. He goes, I had 99 RBIs, never had 100 RBIs, and he struck me out, and I broke the bat. And I'm like, Sean, I promise you in a 5-0 game, if I ever knew this ahead of time, not that I'm trying to blow a game, but as much as I love you, I totally would have figured out a way for you to get that RBI.
Oh my God. Such a great story. Because like I look back at my career, 299 RBI seasons. I mean, clean it up. I couldn't get the 100 RBI. But in that game, 163 versus the Mets, they come into Cincinnati. I'm like, all right, at least I got a shot to get it, right? Mm. So Al comes out dominating, boom, starts the game. You know, everyone in the dugout was like, oh, this isn't going good. Then Alfonso goes deep and, you know, silences the crowd, whatever. So now we're in the ninth, and I believe Pokey Reese.
That's right.
With one out in the ninth or leads off the ninth with a triple. Right? Is that what happened, Al? I think so.
Double.
And then he gets the third. It's only the second hit you've given up. And I'm like, okay, you know, at the end, we're down. It doesn't look good because Al's dominating. But I just got to put the ball in play, get my 100th ribby. At least I'll feel good in the offseason. Freaking Al's out there just, you know, doing his thing. Wham, wham, wham. Just cutter, bam, punches me out. I'm like, oof. Worst case scenario. Like, I can't strike out here. So, bam, 99th ribby, still on third to this day. And I told Al when I came to the network, dude, I said, a little bit of bitterness still rides in my gut a little bit. I'm pissed off I didn't get that 100 RBI. Could you have thrown one down the middle, 91? Just let me hit a grounder to second. You know?
Or at least outer half and let you hit a little base hit to left.
That's it. That's all I needed, brother. That's all I needed, all right, man. Well. So, Al, talk to us, man. You got a lot of action going on. What's Al Leiter doing these days, brother?
I do nothing. I sit in this room.
Just count your money.
Well, I don't know, man. I got my youngest, Caitlin's a junior. Jack just left to go to Texas and then on to Arizona. So, you know, with your crew, like that matters. Kind of like in my life, I keep busy. I'm hyper enough and curious enough to always dabble in stuff. But number one is to like be around the kids and the family and all that stuff. So, I mean, where we are in the world with the hunker down and all this crazy stuff that's going on with COVID, you know, kind of the world has gotten a little bit smaller. But thankfully, knock on wood, status quo has been pretty good. So I'd say everything is good, man. Really.
Well, nice. Dude, listen, take us through a little bit because we know you, brother, as a friend. So we know you not just as a baseball player. We know you as a colleague at the network. We also know you as a dad. And I think that's where I kind of want to start because I'm a dad, too. I have 4 kids. you know, you have three girls and a son. I have two daughters and two sons, you know, two in college, and then I have two at home. And, you know, looking through your story, you know, obviously, before we get into Jack, I want to kind of go to your girls a little bit, because your daughter, Lindsay, was a really good volleyball player. And your other daughters, Carly and Caitlin, they're kind of what, into musicals, not really athletes. Yeah. And my daughter, Carly, is into volleyball, too. And I love girls volleyball. Like, I'm so fired up to go watch those games more than I was high school baseball, because sometimes that's like watching paint dry, you know? You know, can you take us through, like, what's it like raising three girls, dude, and you know, being out lighter and that fired up that you are? What's it like raising three girls for you?
So, Case, on top of that, to understand my history, I'm one of seven. The last of seven kids. My mother and father had seven kids in 9 years. Wow. Six births. I'm a twin. Wow,
watch TV one time.
Right? the Irish Catholic. So here I cut, and my father was like crazy old school male chauvinist, like something, right? You know, finished World War II. So to describe, like, my upbringing was crazy, to put it mildly, with six boys and one girl. In seven kids, six boys in a 9-year span. So, you know, fast forward, meet Lori, start my family, and here I have, you know, Lindsay, Carly, yes, Jack, and then Caitlin. So the girls balance, and I know you got two and two, and Chinch, you're not there yet, right?
No,
as far as you know?
As far as I know.
No. Nobody's come knocking on Chinch's door yet.
No, that's not happening. That's not happening.
Yeah, better not. So Jess would kick your rear end, that's right. Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, it's been, you know, it's been awesome, you know, to watch your kids. But I'll say this. I think as a parent, and I say this a lot, you know, especially being, you know, getting an opportunity to talk to other dads and moms and the kids, I always think about whatever their endeavor is. I kind of call it the Holy Trinity of that interest success. Do you love it? You guys know this. Whatever the hell you do, you better love it.
Yeah.
The second thing is, do you work your friggin' tail off? I mean, work your ass off. I'm talking about where it's unsolicited, you are self-motivated, and you go out there and you work. No matter what it is. We're going to refer to baseball right now, but whatever it is. Case, I'm with you. Watching Lindsay play volleyball and then her travel team. Like, it was awesome. Like, I loved watching. It's an exciting sport. So, and then and the last thing is, do you want to get better? You know, so if you create that tripod of the love, hard work, and do you want to get better? A lot of people say, like, do you love it? And you say, kid, yeah, I love it. Say, do you work hard? Oh, yeah, Mr. Lyer, work hard. Do you want to get better? Like, Sean Casey wasn't a 300 hitter if he wasn't always tinkering and trying and doing things to get better. Oh, the great players we played with, Case, you know it. And I saw some of your podcasts, and it's been awesome watching it. And you just had Tommy on. You talk about another amazing guy. Is that, you know, you're always trying to figure out a way to get a little better. You're never really satisfied. And I remember Derek Jeter saying this, and I got a chance to play eventually with Derek my last year in the big leagues in 2005. And, you know, his thing was, if we don't win, it was a failed year. And here's guy Derek Jeter in his first 5 years, he was in four World Series in the big leagues from 96 to 01 or whatever it was. So that's all he knew. But the idea of, and Derek expressed this, is that, you know, when you're playing, you never really get a chance to enjoy it. And I hate to say that, because it really sucks. I remember seeing Randy Johnson a few years ago, and he came over. You know, Randy's really kind of an eclectic dude. He's an amazing photographer. And he came over to me, Case, at Chinch, and he hugged me. I'm like, hey, Randy. And Randy says, I'm sorry. I was like, sorry for what? He goes, man, when I played, you know, I was ornery. I was this, I was that. Wow. But I get it. Like, it's this whole, you're chasing this thing, and you're scared to death of failure. And, you know, I just read a quote about Keith Hernandez, and he was like, you know, I was always worried about, like, somebody taking my job. So all of that influences greatness, to understand that you always have to have the mindset of trying to get a little bit better. I don't know how the hell I got there on that, but
no, 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 I love it. You know, and that kind of segues into your son, because, you know, we'd be crazy. You've had, obviously, the things you've done, Al, is awesome. But I know as a dad, you know, when your sons are doing something special and something they love, man, that's something that's really cool. Can you take us through Jack's journey? Because we obviously got a chance to get to know him over the years with you coming out to the World Series and being at All-Star Games and stuff. But watching his evolution as a player and now being the second pick of the 2021 draft, I mean, that's unprecedented, right? But take us back to Jack's journey in high school, when what your relationship was like with him and what you were like as a dad on his journey.
Yeah. So similar to you, you know, I know, you know, you'd send me some videos of your boys and, you know, watching and trying to, you know, tweak and get some ideas to help, right? I think the best way I could describe me being a father to my son and being a dad and the love that and the connection there, you know, at times could be, it's fragile because it could be hurtful, right? You know, you're still the dad, you love each other and you give him your heart. So then there becomes the 19 year major leaguer, or you're 12 year major leaguer, 1500 hits, lifetime 300 hitter. And you're trying to convey all the stuff that you were taught to your kid. Some level of frustration might come out, you know, so like, that's where the whole separation of like, just, you know, okay, you go teach my kid, you know?
Right.
It's either A, he's going to kill me, or I'm going to kill him.
Right.
But what I did was, and you guys remember Jack, I mean, he's still not the biggest dude. He's just a smidge under 6'1".
Yeah.
And Kench, you remember him coming around in fourth grade. You too, Case. I don't know. What year did you get to the network, Case?
Yeah. I was there first year with you. I'm an OG, bro. 14 years we've been together. OG, you and me.
So what was he, 9?
You definitely retired too early.
I was 34. I was 34 when you told me that.
It's true. You told him that.
Hey, Chinch, Case comes in. I love him. We hug him. I'm like, what the hell are you doing? He goes, yeah, I'm going to work here. I'm like, wait a minute. You should be still playing. What are you doing?
Yeah, he had 300 the year before. But, hey, back on Jack, because I am so locked in on Jack right now, because Case knows I'm doing this little documentary with him and Anthony Volpe, and I got to hang out with Al and Jack. But the things that impressed me the most about him, and I wonder if you guys as athletes can agree or disagree with this, but the fact that he was undersized seems like all of that stuff when he was growing up from like eighth grade until probably his sophomore years when he started really developing, right? That kind of looking at all those other guys, I remember you brought him to the draft one year and he's like, I played with that guy. I like that guy. I played with that guy. And it was like, he was starting to go, wait a minute, I'm catching up to these guys. But he had to work 7 times as hard to be the undersized kid to get where he was. And that's got to be a testament to the upbringing you gave him, right?
Yeah. Chinch. So yes, everything you said, check. And this is where I boil it back to. And my comments and conversations with Jack through the years, as you say, and even before that, right? I mean, I was, you know, he was barely walking when I was at my apartment in New York City when we were living up there year round when I was at the Mets. And, you know, I had little bounce house balls all over the floor and he would just go around, you know, like a little kid, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he throws the ball. And we have a whiff ball bat, and he's like hitting crap off the TV and the lights and all that. And I was like, yeah. I used to like, he'd be walking around. You know me, I'm crazy at the. And you know, most people when they throw the ball, you know, they take the ball and they, you can see people don't, you know, and they elbows below your shoulder and they throw like darts, right?
Right.
They do the dart throwing. And I'd be crawling on the floor, and Jack would pick up the ball. He's a little guy, and he'd start throwing it, and I would pick his elbow up, and he'd throw. And Jack would look at me like, hey, what are you doing, man? Let me alone. So, but, you know, that kind of thing. So here, it sounds maniacal, but it's not. But I always got to, and especially because how often I was hurt early in my career. I had my first surgery at 23 years old in 1989. I had my second surgery in 1991. You know, there's a lot of doubt in the early part of my career. I did very little as a result of injury. So as a father, I couldn't hit. Like I had guys like Sean Casey. Remember where were we at the Garden a few years ago? And we're in the suite. Remember?
We were at the hockey game.
And you're like, yeah, teaching. Yeah. You know, and I still had this. I still had this dream of Jack being like Robin Ventura. You know, left-handed hitting third baseman. Die, get dirty. Like, I didn't want him to be on the mound. Right. Wow, yeah. The last thing he needs is to be like Al Leiter, Jack Leiter. He's pitching. Right. You know, the comparison, all that bullshit. So my thing was, you know, the mechanics of it, and if you always focus on the things that you can control, then that's it. Like, you control what you can control. And I know it seems like BS that you read in books, but it's true. And then whatever that is, between the love of something, working your tail off and wanting to get better, and then focus on the things you can control, the mechanics of it, no matter whether it's a volleyball game or wrestling or singing or dancing or hitting 300 in the big leagues or throwing 95, there's a mechanics to all of it, right? So then you get to that, to where you're trying to conceptualize and teach what you think is optimal, and then you roll the dice. I used to tell Jack all the time, it's like, Jack, I don't know what baseball could get to you. I know you love it. You love being with your boys. You love being on travel. You know, he's a guy's guy. Does it get you into college? Great. Does it get you to a better school like you, Chinch? You go to Columbia. Maybe Jack would have been good. You know, maybe he was only, you know, maybe you got him into a better college. Like, right, that kind of mindset. It was never like, hey, you're going to be a badass, going to be the best, like bullshit. Right. He was the dude that was batting seventh, eighth, or ninth on the team. Purposely, I kept him off the mound in travel ball because, you know, you hear the horror stories, although it's getting better with pitch counts. And that was it. Like, there really wasn't, like, and you're right, Chinch. Like, I'm telling you, Case, his travel team, he batted seventh, eighth, or ninth when he did get in the game. And if there was a three-game series on the weekend, he would start one of the three games.
Wow.
And he still loved it. Yeah. And I didn't mind it because I got the vision of all of this. But he'd come back to the house. We'd go in the batting cage. He'd get on the mound. He would, like, we'd work. Mm. I'm like, that's how you get better. You work. You keep working and working and working.
I want to stay here. I want to stay here, Al, because, man, it sounds like the conversations I have with my sons, and it's a fine line that you kind of walk because you're like, okay, I need to be a dad, but I also have so much knowledge. But you and I have one thing in common, and I was going to go later, but I'm going to go here because I think it fits. Harvey Dorfman, who, without Harvey Dorfman, I probably don't play a day in the big leagues. I know you probably don't have the career that you end up having in the big leagues without Harvey Dorfman. And I know what he meant. Now, Harvey Dorfman was the mental game of baseball. Hey, there you go, bro. There you go.
This isn't a prop, Chinch.
There it is.
I have this. I bet he does too. I have this nearby, and every single kid. There you go. Every single kid that I talk to, you got the metal
keys to hitting.
Look at this.
No, both of them.
We're gonna play dueling banjos now with Harvey Dorfman.
Yeah. No, but I love it.
What's Dorfman paying you guys?
I love it. I love it.
And Harvey passed away. Like, it's about 9 years, 7 years.
But my thing, Al, is that one of the things that when I, you know, I look back at your you know, what you did with what you did with Jack was that I know how big the ABCs of pitching was. I know how big Harvey Dorfman was for you, and you started early in Jack's high school career, started charting his pitches. Right, there you go. The mental ABCs of pitching. And listen, if anyone's listening to this show or watching the show, I tell the same thing. I said, you want to get good at baseball? Anyone, right, Al said right there, anyone could come and take the swings and throw the ball and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, this is a game of failure. It will eat you up if mentally you're not ready to go. And mentally you don't have some tools. You can't bring a butter knife to a gunfight. And I think an Uzi fight, because, you know, that's what the mind is. And when I look at Jack, and I watched him at Vanderbilt, I was lucky enough to catch those games, and I was excited because, you know, he's your son, and you know, I'd known him growing up, and it was fun to watch, man. But one thing I knew, and knowing it from the baseball eye of what I was watching, the way he sequenced pitches, the way he would, you know, he had such a demeanor that he could get back into the pitch if he gave up a walk or a hit. And I know that was you, Al, and I know that was your influence. Not every kid has that. Talk to us about the influence of Harvey Dorfman, what he meant to you, but also the fact that you were able to pass that on to your son, and it worked.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
So that's awesome, Case. I met Harvey Dorfman in 1991. My first pitching coach, Gil Patterson, who's a longtime pitching coach in was in the big leagues, a coordinator with the Yankees, and now is the pitching coordinator with the Oakland A's. How I found out about Harvey was Gil was my first pitching coach in Oneonta, New York, in the Penn League. The Yankees got rid of him. He was signed by the A's, and he was in the A's system for years. And I knew Gil. I mean, he was a dear friend. And we would work on all the mental, you know, the mechanics. And he said, "Hey, you know who you need to meet?" He goes, "You need to meet Harvey Dorfman." I'm like, "The mental game of baseball guy?" He's like, "Yeah." And I said, "How could I do that?" He goes, "The A's hired him years ago, and he was with the Oakland A's, but, you know, like the mental guy," which is what they didn't do. Chintz, you have no. Yeah. When I first got to the big leagues, we didn't have a strength coach.
Right. No, that's true. No, but also back then too, when you first got to the big leagues, what like a head shrinker? That was kind of looked.
Oh yeah, no. Right? Here, let me say this. So I'm in 1985. I am awful. I go high school, New Jersey, to Oneonta, New York Penn League. I held my own. It was a good league for me. That offseason, the New York Yankees got rid of their Sally League team, which was their low A. So for a high school kid, people out there might think like it's no big deal.
It's a big deal. But
yeah, you kind of need a kid to develop at the right pace, right? You don't want them to get overwhelmed and then lose confidence, all that crap. So they did away with the Sally League, and the Yankees, you went from the Penn League to the Florida State League. Florida State League back then was a very good league. It was all college guys. There might have been one or two high school kids sprinkled on a team, but it was an experienced league. I go to the Penn League, and I think I end up throwing like 100-something innings, and I walk like 80 or 90 guys. Case, it was like spraying balls, thinking every dude that went to University of Miami or Arizona
State. I was going to go deep.
Guy I heard out of UCLA, I had to throw it 105. Yeah. And I'm like, it was freaking nuclear loose, right? So right here, I'm going to tell you, Bucky Dent was my manager, and somebody thought it was a good idea to get me hypnotized. Hey, me of all people.
That's amazing.
So wait a minute. So I listen to Bucky. He goes, "Yeah, I got this hypnotize. He's going to come in. He's going to hypnotize it." I'm like, okay. So we're at the Fort Lauderdale Stadium. You know, I get there on the right time, and I go back in this little room. Some guy comes in, and we start, you know, whatever. And he's like, "Okay, lay down." I'm telling you, man, the guy's doing the thing. And he's like trying to do the thing. Yeah. And I'm sitting there going like this. And I want to laugh. I'm like, so we get to a point, and I just stop the guy. I'm like, "I'm sorry, sir. But like, this just doesn't work for me. Like, I am so hyper. I'm following the damn birdie and thinking about like doing my laundry and what's his lunch." Here, Chintz, this is the point. Like, this is where we went. We came from as a sport. Right. If if anything was mental, mentally, you're not tough enough. Yeah, what do you mean?
Yeah, there's something wrong with you. Yeah, yeah.
It's so wrong. Like this is almost everything. When I finally figured it out,
everything.
That was more than my 92 mile slider and the it was this. So when you say Case, when you say about Jack. If Jack were to get on this for 2 seconds and you asked him, "Jack, what is your job as a pitcher?" He will recite something that I've been reciting to him, and not just my son, to all pitchers that I encounter, is to be mentally and physically prepared to execute a quality pitch consecutively until either the manager takes the ball or the game is over, without allowing the exterior distractions to come into the task at hand. Chinch, I probably blurred this stuff on there.
No, you have.
You know,
that's so good. That is that's gold.
But think about it. Wait, here, Case. I want to hear.
Mark that.
Oh yeah.
But I want to hear. I want to hear what Harv said on the hitting side. But here, let me finish that. Not one thing did I say strike him out. Not one thing did I say throw a shutout. Not one time do I say get a win. Right. Not one time do I say go deep into the game or innings or battle or it's all bullshit. Yeah. That what you're trying to do is to be mentally and physically prepared to execute a quality pitch. This pitch. Right. Sean Casey's, I'm going down and away. I better not go up and away because he's going to pepper a ball off a left center. And then I'm going to go two heaters inside, and I'm going to get a big, powerful breaking ball. Hopefully he rolls over and goes to first. I could control everything that I just said. I didn't say I'm going to strike him out. I didn't say anything about result. None of it. Right. And this is where guys get – when you get lost – you get lost into like not knowing what you're doing. You got to get back to what you could control. Yeah. So it's everything. It was everything for me. I had games where I had nothing. I think it was actually the game that I beat all 30 major league teams. I forget what year it was. I think it was 02 or 01. It was against Arizona in Arizona. And Piazza always used to come down the line, right field, the bullpen in behind the fence there, Case, you know, on the right field line.
Yep.
So I'm throwing, and I'm telling you, Chinch, I've got nothing. I promise you. It's not like, oh, yeah, whatever, Al. No, I had nothing. I think I might have broke like 88. So Piazza's coming down, and I told him, I was like, Mike, get out of here. Like, get. I didn't want Mike to see the last 5 minutes of my warm-up. Because he'd be going into like Bobby Valentine saying, get somebody to warm up. This was the year after the D-backs won. So Gonzalez Matt Wins and who the heck else is on that team? They had a good team. Yeah. Oh, Mark Grace.
Womack. Yeah, Council. J-Bell.
Yeah.
They were loaded.
Look it up. I forget. I went like seven scoreless. And you know what I did? I said, this wasn't about like busting the 90 miles an hour. I'd have been out of the game. I said, okay, what do I have to do? Okay, I got to keep the ball down. I'm not blowing it by anybody. I better hit the freaking glove, move my fastball around, really use both breaking balls. Like it became like a in my control. And I cite that because it was the result ended up being successful as it was, not because of what was coming out of my arm, but like how I controlled this.
Yeah. And the cool thing about that, real quick, you told me, I was like, what do you do when you're watching a game with Jack? Can you tell us when you and Jack watch games, you're constantly pitch sequencing with him, right? Like when you watch a playoffs, this is so cool. Sean, listen to this. Right?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been kind of messing with Jack, even when he was in high school. Once I started seeing like his stuff getting to be able to get big league hitters out, I'll be honest with you. Like, you know, Case, you know, whatever.
Exactly. I do the same thing.
Yeah. So when he would throw, I'd have to reinforce it because the only way you know you could do something is if you go and do it, right? Like the first time you ever got to the big leagues, Case, it wasn't it like, oh my God, like I'm in the big leagues.
Yep.
What was it? I don't know. What was your?
Oh, I first got to the big leagues. Yeah, and then I shit my pants. I'm like, oh my God, that's David Cohn. That's David Cohn out there. You know what I mean? Like, you got to actually face David Cohn and Randy Johnson and Greg Maddux, and then go and Al Leiter, then go. Okay, I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Yes,
I can do this. Yes.
So, like anything else in life, once you experience it and hopefully get good result, you know, it becomes part of your DNA. You're like, oh, I can do this, but. You can say it till you're blue in the face. Somebody's got to actually experience it, right? Chance, I'll even say for you. We're talking baseball.
Right.
But you're a hell of a producer. You were the best that we had. Thank you. Like when you first time you ever sat in that seat,
clueless.
I'm sure you had the same like, oh my God, what am I going
to
do?
Clueless. I'll even take it to what we're doing right now, sitting here. Me and Casey tell the story. We rehearsed to practice to see if we could do it, and we thought our friendship was over. I swear to God, we were so bad, and it was like This is going to be a mistake. And actually, when I look back at the very first show we did compared to now, you see the progress and you see, okay, I had to keep doing it to get better at it. So I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I always tell Mike, one of my favorite lines, if my kids were there to say the same thing, you can't teach experience. You have to take action and you have to go. And that's why I think the mental tools are so important. Al, just a quick note about Harvey Dorfman, like, the stuff that he taught me is so much of the stuff that he taught you. And I look at moments in my life, and you were talking about that game where you went seven scoreless and you felt like you didn't have your great stuff. I remember in the 2006 World Series, and I've told this story before, but it's worth telling with Al here. 2006 World Series, it's game five, Adam Wainwright on the mound. He's throwing 98 miles an hour with a nasty hook and a good changeup. On the second out, I would have been the second out of game five in the ninth. So they're two outs away from World Series title. We're down two runs, nobody on base. Wainwright throws me a first pitch heater. I swing and miss. Next pitch changeup. I swing and miss. Has me 0-2. I step out of the box. The crowd is so deafening. It is so loud. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, is that loud? Like, I had a moment where I was like, man, where am I? Like, this is so loud, right? But I remember it was like all that training of all these years of conversations with Harvey. No, control what I can control. Mm-hmm. Get back in, breathe or die. Get back into your breath. And I remember taking two breaths there to get back in that moment. Get back in the moment. Get back in the box. Get back into this one-on-one battle with Wainwright. Well, I remember gathering myself, getting back to my process, slowing myself down. I got back in the box, Al. Well, I tell you what, this crowd is still going nuts. All of a sudden, I don't hear them. Right. I just see Wainwright. And I think to myself, Harvey used to have me write three things on a note card. See the ball, be easy, and hammer it. Those are the three things I said. So I had that in my pocket, right? Yeah. And I would look at it on the on-deck circle. So I got back in the box. I looked back and I said, all right, I'm hunting the fastball. See the ball, hammer it, right? I get back to 3-2. Sure enough, the 3-2 pitch, he throws me a 97-mile-an-hour. Bam, I hit a rocket off the fence, double, right? We end up losing the game, lose the World Series. But I go back to that at bat. And that's when I say thank you so much to Harvey Dorfman. And reading this book when I was 16 years old, my dad got it for me, and I just happened to, you know, kind of stumbled on it. Without that knowledge, I never even would have been in the big leagues or the World Series or a 300 hitter or the chance to do the things I did. So I know how strong the mind is, and being able to live in the moment, focus on the task at hand is a skill, mm-hmm. and it's to be worked on every day. And that moment, I look back, one of the coolest moments of my career.
Oh, good. And I'll bring you on this, Chinch. What did Case say anything about, oh my God, don't mess up, don't strike out here?
No, yeah, all positive.
What am I going to do? What's he going to do? No, he said, see the ball. I could do that. Pick up the ball. Be smooth. What did he say? Be easy.
See the ball. Be easy.
Be easy. So not like, yeah. You know, sawdust the bat. And then smash it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. That's all. Like that's beautiful. So
it's
right?
Simplifying things, but also taking out the self doubt out of it. I guess is what you guys are saying with this.
Well, that's true. Right? That yeah. The whole like like hope is not a word. Even try. I mean, we can pull in our buddy Leland.
Yeah.
Try. I get my damn landscaper to try. I don't try. What's he do? Awesome. I don't know if he pulled that on your podcast.
Oh yeah, that, but he pulled that to me in my career. You know, I'm trying out there. I got a truck. He said I got a truck driver out here to try.
Oh, he I guess when up in Detroit he was saying truck driver, but in Florida he was saying landscaper.
So great, dude. Oh, it's so great, man. So Al, let's switch gears, bro. Let's get back to you. Let's get down the road. You get drafted by the Yankees. You. Like you said, you grind a little bit through the minor leagues, but you finally get called up. And I one of the stories I have interest in is Billy Martin was your manager, right?
My first full year, Billy Martin was a manager.
Your first full year. Can you talk about what he was like and how, what was the feeling for you getting called up to the biggies with the Yankees? With, you know, was there so much fear there?
Yeah, fear and doubt, scared. When I say I was scared to death in my first big league start in September 16th of 1987. So this is when George was raging, right? There was like a different manager like all yeah. the time. So when I got called up, Lou Piniella was the manager. He fired Lou at the end of the year and he made Billy Martin the manager for like the fifth time. And initially I thought it was the coolest thing, right? I'm going to spring training, legendary Billy Martin. You hear all the stories. All I knew is that I'm staying away from this guy because I'm, you know, I don't want to be the marshmallow man or Ed Whitson, you know. I don't want him to punch me. So he liked me, you know, whatever. I was the young up and coming next guy, right? But clearly an interesting generational separation. First of all, like Leland, and I don't know where he got it from, but maybe he got it from Billy because Billy was in Detroit. He wore cleats. What manager were, and I'm not talking about the plastic ones. I'm talking about metal cleats.
Spikes high, yeah.
Yeah. So, Chich, you're walking in the dugout, you look at your manager, and he's like 85 years old, he's wearing cleats. You're like,
what? Yeah, he was like 85 pounds at the time, too. So that's funny. Yeah. It's a funny image.
So, but it was so generational. And I think he was intimidating and respected because he was Billy Martin. And I was on a, my first year in the big leagues in that rotation. This is funny because I told Jack that I was in the rotation with Tommy John. This was years ago. And he's like, Tommy John, he's a person. He's not the surgeon.
Oh my God. Like, really?
No, but I'm saying like, this is years ago when I say the rotation was me, Richard Dotson, Rick Roden, John Candelaria, Tommy John.
I remember it clearly.
Wait a minute. Here, this is cool. I don't have a dig me room, but I do have this photo.
I love it.
This guy's the best. Just for everybody at home, Al has just left the picture. He's in his office. He's got champagne in his office. So, he's got a globe.
I'll be honest. I don't have much. Yeah. Wow. Lights are really bad, aren't they? So I don't have much. So this is going to look kind of whatever. You guys can think what you want, but I don't have much. This was the first rotation in my can you see that?
Oh, yeah, I can see it. Yep. Send me a picture of that, too, and I'll put it
on the left. You're on the left, Rick Roden.
Look at that.
The candy man.
You got John Candelaria, Richard Dotson, Tommy John, Rick Roden, and me.
Wow.
This is my first rotation, you guys. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
Tommy John was like 50. Candy was like late 30s. Dot was probably early 30s. He was Richard. Rick Roden was late 30s, and it was me. I'm like 21 years old.
Oh my
God. So I came into that. But here in my office, I have two things. This was my first rotation, and this was my last start in the big leagues.
Wow. Look at that.
And I have it right next to each other. So I'm walking out, and you never know when your last is. Yeah. This is in Oakland. I'd like totally pooped the bed. Here's Joe Torre coming out, and I got Posada,
A-Rod, Jeter,
Cano. You got Giambi a little bit back there, but that was the last. So my first and my last, and I put it up on the wall.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Was there some sort of mound visit? I kind of remember you telling me that he came out to the mound and just destroyed you one day, Billy Martin.
Billy Martin, yeah. So, I mean, the go-to for his pitching coach, Art Fowler, was, it was funny. He'd come out. He was like a big old guy from North Carolina, and something was going on. But it was his way of diffusing, you know, the tension. He's like, man, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. You tell me. He's like, you got good stuff. You got good stuff. Just put the ball over the plate. And I'm looking at him like, no shit. He goes, I know one thing. You're pissing Billy off. And he turns around, he walks away. And whoever the catcher was, I had Rick Cerrone, I had Don Slott,
Matt Noakes, Joel Skinner.
Yeah, Joel Skinner. And we would just look at each other. Like, there was no, like, hey, get your arm up, closed, you know, follow. You got good stuff. Put the ball over the plate. No, here it was. So, Chinch, that year in 88, I hadn't had a win in a few starts. I started out like 4-0, and then I it was like really dry, whatever. I forget, either pitching poorly or – and it was Monday Night Baseball when they had Monday Night Baseball, guys, on ABC.
Yeah. Yep.
Which maybe people out there are like, big deal, what's a big deal?
Was that was the biggest thing in a world. The biggest thing in the world.
Because we didn't have
baseball.
All the games weren't televised. Right. We didn't have all these. Right. We didn't have all that.
No, that was it.
It's Saturday game of the week with Joe Garagiola. If your team was on there, that was cool. And the Yankees, we were on a lot. Right. And then Monday Night Baseball with it was Jim Palmer and was Cosell still on?
I don't know. What's his name? Going to be Michaels? A barn burner.
Al Jackson. Yeah.
Jackson.
Anyway, so it's in Tiger Stadium. The Tigers were good, right? So they were, you know, whatever. They came off, 84. But Gary Ward hits a grand slam. And Jack Morris is pitching. And I'm pitching against Jack Morris. And I get a blister. I used to get a blister really bad. Right. Mr. Blister. And it was the start of my – because everything came off the seam, right? So I had four seam, my cutter. I really, really pulled down on the cutter. I really pulled down on a curveball. Didn't have a two-seamer, and my changeup stunk. So, like, it was always, like, friction, right? So I'm literally – the pad on here was like an oval racetrack on my middle finger. And it was – the skin peeled off, And like people have blisters before, right? And it's bleeding, but it's dripping blood, right? So it's two outs in the fifth inning. Chet Lemon is up. And I'm patting my leg to just figure out a way to get one more out to get the W. And Gene Monahan, I guess our trainer, noticed like I have a blotch of blood on my leg. Tiger Stadium dugout, old Tiger Stadium on the first base line. And Billy comes timeout. He comes walking out, and oh my God, Chinch, did he rip me a new one? You dumb son, bop 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 bop. What? And I'm looking at him. He's this big. I'm like, oh shit. I hope he doesn't punch me right now. So. Because of that, and the silliness of a blister, it literally, I was on the DL for like 2 months.
Oh my God.
Because it's one of those things where, I feel good. I'm coming back. And then all of a sudden it heats up, you know, that bullshit.
Right, sure.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Billy did not punch me. And
Al, really quick. I know you were up there a little bit, but Mattingly was like my idol. Did you get a chance to like, kind of like, feel the mystique of Donnie Baseball?
Oh my God. You talk of a legend, right? So, you know, and again, this, it was strange for me a little bit because I grew up a Mets fan growing up in New Jersey. My dad loved the Lovable Losers. He loved Casey Stengel, and he actually liked the Mets because they lost and they were the underdog. And my dad didn't actually like them. My dad was born in Manhattan, but my dad didn't like the Mets or the Yankees because they won all the time. Like, how's, you know, it's the opposite of what everybody else, right? So I get drafted by the Yankees, I sign, and then 3 years out of high school, I'm pitching at Yankee Stadium. My debut, I got Rick Cerrone, I got Don Mattingly at first, Willie Randolph at second, Bobby Meacham at third, Bobby Meacham at short, Pags at third, Winfield at right, Henderson had left, and Claudel Washington.
Wow. One of the best offensive teams Yankees had in the 80s. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. No, they were brand names, right? Hall of Fame guys. But Donnie, one thing that stood out, Case, was even with Billy Martin and certainly with Lou Piniella and Dallas Green, which was my last manager with the Yankees in 89, Don Mattingly would take over infield bunt plays in spring training. It was cool. I'm telling you, Case, I you could appreciate this being the first baseman. They would just refer to Donnie. Hey, Donnie, what do you want to do on the wheel play? Hey, Donnie, where do you want the pitchers on the one play? Donnie, what do you think they should do on the two play? So, you know, I'm sitting here as a young guy. And, of course, it's Don Mattingly, great hitter, you know, batting champ and all that. But he took over infield bunt plays for Billy, of course, had a say. But they would refer to Donnie, like he was clearly that guy, you know? I mean,
that's so cool. That's so cool to hear.
And humble too. Donnie's a Midwest Indiana boy, humble as can be. Great guy.
God, I know, man. When first time I ever met him, I'm like, I had him sign a bat for me in spring training and the pen didn't work. I'm like, oh my God, the pen doesn't work. And it was like the silver pen, paint pen. And like he wrote Don Mattingly and it kind of like just smudged it. I'm like, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. Whatever is on here, at least I can say it was you that wrote it.
You know, you know it was him. I think you told us that story. Was that the Hitman poster that was around?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the Hitman poster was in. Yeah. And then I would come back and stay with my parents whenever we play the Pirates. I go in. Bam, there's the Hitman poster still on my wall. Right. I was like, let's go.
That one was right next to Farrah Fawcett, right?
Yes,
it was
perfect.
Two of my interests, two of my biggest interests. So, Al, you also talk a lot about Dave Rigetti and what Rags, you know, meant to you, you know, as not only as a player, but as a person. Could you talk about your relationship with him?
So Rags definitely took me under his wing. He saw similarity, lefty, you know, hard thrower, you know, definitely I needed to be contained, goofy, you know, curious, kind of bouncing all over the place. So Rags wanted to make sure that I behaved the way a big leaguer should. And like to this day, like I appreciate, like I didn't appreciate or understand what he was doing while he was doing it. But now knowing at, over the years of my time in the big leagues and what I tried to impart on, say, the younger kid or the younger player, but just how to act. And, you know, he'd give me that look once in a while, or, you know, he, you know, he'd put me in my place, and it was all very benign, like playful stuff. But like, I understood what he was doing. And the biggest thing, Case, and you can appreciate this, cause I don't know who the, that player was on your team, yeah, as far as the guy
Barry,
that was
Barry Larkin,
Barry Larkin was, I didn't want to disappoint Rags. I wanted him to like me, but I also wanted to, I wanted to behave and do what he was trying to teach, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Rigetti, the lineage here, because I got a chance to play with Ron Guidry as well, the lineage of Sparky Lyle Gator to Rags, to me, I mean, that was kind of what, at that time, they were hoping that I was going to be kind of the next lefty thing, you know? Injury and whatever went sideways, and then I get traded. But so I knew that, because I knew when Rags talked so nice and had a affinity for Sparky Lyle and that kind of thing. And then here comes, you know, other guys that via through Sparky to Rag to Guidry to Rigetti. I think, you know, we're kind of like going in a lot of, it seems like we're going in a lot of different places, but we're saying the same thing. That the fact of experienced players, experienced yes, people, we were mentioning about, you got to go out and do it, right?
Right.
That in the game, and I hope it doesn't get there, but the value of that, I don't even want to say journeyman because it sounds like a guy who's hanging on, but the value of that player. And Chinch, maybe you could start blurting out some players in the last 5, 7, 8 years, yeah, that you keep that guy around because it's right, more than what he, who?
Albert Pujols right now, wherever he was, wherever he's
going. Oh, yeah, the next Pujols, year, you know, like, see the next level stuff. But
right,
boy, I'm blanking right now. But I can't say the enough.
Giambi's last 3 years in the big leagues, he barely picked up a bat, but they needed him on those teams.
Chase Utley in L.A. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You're right.
So we, you know, to, like that, it's more than just the pinch hit or an occasional start. It's having that voice and that experience around the kid, yeah, who needs to feel that legacy of taking the baton and passing it to the next right, guy. And Junior got it from his guy in Don Mattingly. Like it was so.
Yeah, I'll take it a step further because I can relate this to just, you know, people who don't play the sports, but it's the same concept. I always say, like, when I started getting into, like, managerial roles and there are people underneath you, I've learned, like, you know, there's whole Machiavellian thing, right, where it's like better be feared than loved, whatever. I always say one of the biggest things is you don't want, like, your employees or, you know, the young player with the old player. The biggest sign of a good leader is you want people that aren't going to be scared that you're going to get mad at them. You want them to be upset if they disappointed you. And what you said that about Rigetti, like a leader, a good leader is one that really literally, like, you just want to do your best for them because you know that that leader has your back and you know that they're teaching you all the things you need to be a better person or a better player and all that stuff. So I love that point you made.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of that quandary of a parent. And I see a lot of parents that want to be friends and pals with their kids, as opposed to you're still the father. Like you have to be a father once in a while. And, you know, fathers have to say things and put your kid back in their place. And, you know, there's some tough love at times and, right, you know, that's okay.
And that's like, why it's good to have the 38-year-old player who's at the tail of his, right, end of his career with the 22-year-olds, and there's 20 of them there, right?
Yep.
Well, I know one father figure, if he was still alive, would be pissed off right now that he traded Al Leiter to the Blue Jays, and that's George Steinbrenner. Because I don't think that – I'm just saying. I know Jesse Barfield was a great player, but at that time they traded a young Al Leiter who ended up having an unbelievable career for Jesse Barfield, who was on the way out. So – George right now is listening to this right now and going, man, we never should have traded Al Leiter. What are we, nuts? So, bro, so that you get traded from the Yankees to the Blue Jays. And I think this is when, you know, the evolution of Al Leiter, you finally come off those injuries, the blisters, all the things that happened, a couple surgeries, and now you're with the Blue Jays. What happened, Al? What was it mentally, physically that took you to another level there in Toronto?
So I finally got healthy. I had two shoulder operations. What was identified after the trade was that I was pitching with a bum arm, but mostly there's a thing, atrophy of the infraspinatus. The infraspinatus is a decelerator. It's in your subscapula. There's nerve impingement that has muscles atrophies. So as a result, I didn't have a very important rotator cuff muscle that would keep the humerus from not popping out of the joint. Once I identified what it was, and then having a couple shoulder surgeries by Dr. Andrews, I was able to strengthen all of the other muscles to complement something I didn't have. So it really became me identifying what the hell was going on.
Wow.
But it was also a lot of soul searching epiphany moments, because I thought my career was done. I was up at the September of 87. I was up in 88 and 89. I get traded and I get hurt. So I'm 23 years old. I have my first surgery. I have my second surgery at 25. And there was a lot of hit and miss going through those years. Like you look at my baseball reference. I did nothing until, you know, 93 was my coming out party. It was really 92. I was a big league pitcher in Syracuse in 92, but we were such a badass team. We won the World Series. We beat the Braves that year.
Yeah.
I got called up in September and was like on the taxi squad. Wow. And just watched. But I pitched an inning at the end of the year in 92.
Yeah.
But that season,
just so for the numbers real quick, it's 14 games in 1988, 89-5, then 4 with Toronto. You really didn't pitch more than 9 games a year for those few years that you were coming back.
Yeah. I mean, when I hear guys, and especially the sport, saying, you know, guys in their late 20s or, you know, hitting 30, they're on their back nine. Get the hell out of here. There's no way. Some of my best stuff that I pitched, I was in my early mid-30s. I was. So when I hear that, I don't buy that. The only thing that will stop a guy today is that he's not motivated to either make another All-Star game, win a World Series, or try to make the Hall of Fame, because they made too much money. And I'm not knocking it, but guys were grinding it out for years. Yes, they loved the game, but they were also needed the paycheck. And yeah, before me, right. You know. So now you got guys, you know, they sign a 5 or 6 year deal. They hit 31 or 32. They've made $125 million, that they take it to the house. Yep. You know, so good for them, but like, no, there's plenty left in the 32 to 36 year old player, easily.
Take us back.
Oh, here, I'm sorry, Case, okay. I didn't answer.
Go ahead.
So I finally get healthy, but back to this dude. I met Harvey Dorfman in 1991, and it changed my mental game. And that was the transformation of me understanding and identifying what my job was. So, yeah, I was so free and easy at that time in my baseball life to admit to this of what was going on in between my ears that helped transform me into being a good pitcher, a tough pitcher, mentally tough. You know, get on the mound. I'm battling you. Sean Casey's a hell of a hitter, but okay, let's go.
Let's get it on.
Whatever great player. I actually enjoyed facing the better hitters in lineups. It sounds a little crazy. The guys that got me often were the dude that like was batting seventh or eighth, and all of a sudden he pops a double down the line. I'm like, damn. You know, what? You know, I don't want to mention names, but like you get through like, you know, Bonds and Kent and whoever, and then all of a sudden some dude like whack. He's like, what?
Right.
But I elevate it to like, okay, Tony Gwynn's batting right now. All right. Or, you know, pick your brand name guy through the 80s and 90s. And
how did you attack Tony Gwynn? I want to hear this.
So Tony, I wasn't worried about left on left of him hitting a home run. So my feeling is that I tried to come in enough to keep the ball away and hopefully hit it at somebody. I promise you, Case, he hit the scouting report of pitching coaches and the analytics and all the stuff that goes on is that he's going to put the ball in play. Well, you didn't strike out much either. Did you ever strike out 100 times in a season?
No, never. 80. I struck out 81 years. That's it.
Yeah. So you're in the same mold, dude. You really are. But, you know, Tony took it to another level. A guy could bet, I think he could have batted 400 that the 1 year.
94, yeah.
Yeah, 94. He's going to put it in play and hopefully hits it somebody. That was it. And if he hit it, if there was nobody on base, it was get the two guys out in front of him. He's going to hit it to the 5.5 hole. Hopefully we're in the right position. We throw him out. Yeah. Honestly. Yeah. Like, and I was okay with that. If Tony Gwynn was 2 for 3, you know, couple singles, and, you know, you beat the Padres 5-2, like, all right. You know, that was a great game.
He was 10 for 22 for a .455 batting average. But to your point, 3 doubles, 1 homer, and 2 ribbies in your entire career against him. So that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
What year did he have the homer?
When? I don't know. I'm not a real researcher. This is
I want to stay in your mind here as a pitcher really quick. Bonds. How'd you face Bonds?
Oh, BB. So BB, totally on the plate, choked up a little bit. You talk about plate coverage he was so close to the plate that there was no way something out or third that he wasn't going to get barrel on it.
So did he eliminate your cutter? Because, you mean, your cutter was your bread and butter. Now, you know, he could take that pitch middle away and hammer it.
I didn't throw him a cutter. I went fastballs in, big curveballs. And the bigger vertical I could get and the slower but still not baby it was the best. I went hard in all the time, preferably up. He had a little window inside, very small, on the plate inside. He didn't like the ball in. He had the big pad, if you remember.
Yep.
But it was harder because the window, left-on-left window, it's hard visual to see the batter here, and then I'm trying to go body line without hitting him.
Yeah,
right.
But yeah, that was it. But I how did Barry do? Did Barry get me? He got me when I first.
Two bombs, but honestly, technically for Barry Bonds, you had great success off of him. He hit 300. He was 9 for 30, but 2 triples probably when he was young, and 2 homers, but really nothing. 5 RBIs.
That's good against Bonds.
Only 4 walks, and you struck him out 6 times. I mean, you pretty much, that's dominating Barry Bonds when he was playing, you know?
I'm going to call BS on the second home run. I think he only hit 1 home run.
I mean, all right. I'll call the reference.
We got bad research on the mayor's office.
Because I mean, there are certain guys that, and probably for you too, Case, when you face that certain pitcher. But Barry, there's not a whole lot of guys I remember a lot of the bats. But Barry Bonds hit a low liner my first year in the National League in 1996. Came over from Toronto to the Marlins at the old Candlestick and hit like a line drive into the they had the stands that accordion back when the 49ers were playing. I don't know if you guys ever been.
I played there.
Yeah, so he ripped it into those right over the wall. But I don't remember 2 homers, huh?
That's what it says. They could be wrong. People are wrong.
Says. So Al, you win your first World Series that year in 93 with the Blue Jays, and you know, this is when you really did well. You did well in the postseason. It was your first, you know, time getting after it. You know, I go back and look at that lineup of Tony Fernandez, Roberto Alomar, Dave Winfield, Paul Molitor, Devon White, Joe Carter, John Olerud, Ricky Henderson. Almost ridiculous, that lineup top to bottom.
Kelly Gruber,
you know, what was that like for you being such a big part of that team that wins it all? Toronto.
So it was fulfilling to say the least because, you know, after getting called up at the end of September, I was not part of the postseason roster in 92, but still the experience of being in an organization that was going in the right direction. So 93, I started and relieved. It was Stottlemyre ended up being the top 4 starters for the postseason. Todd Stottlemyre. We had a young Pat Henkin who came on.
Right.
We had Jack Morris, Dave Stewart. We had
Juan Guzman.
Yeah, Guzman was another guy that came on. I think Jimmy Key had left to go to the Yankees and might have still had Dave Steeb, who was hurt. Yeah, it was amazing. So
Cone, right? Wasn't Cone a hired gun? David Cone?
Yeah, well, Coney came over in 92. Yeah, right. And then he came back in 95.
Right.
And then we traded him to the Yankees that year. Yeah. They went on to that was the year that they almost, right? They lost to Seattle.
Right, exactly.
So from Toronto, though, you end up going to the Marlins and in 1996, correct? 1996.
That is right.
And you throw the first ever no hitter for the Marlins. And it, you know, looking back at your numbers too, you know, pretty impressive what you did in 1996, 2.93 ERA, over 200 punch outs. It's your first All-Star game. But I want to talk about that no-hitter and what that was like pitching a no-hitter and the old question, like, when did you realize you had it and what were you feeling in the ninth?
Yeah, so the ninth had definitely felt like, you know, that you know, I'm going to throw this no-hitter. I'm going to do everything possible. So it was weird. We had a big lead early on. So it was in May. I don't know what the attendance was, but there was a hockey game. The owner of the Marlins, Wayne Huizenga, also on the Panthers, and they were in the finals, in the Eastern Conference Finals against the Flyers. So in between every inning, you talk about how crazy it is. And you've been to the old stadium, right? So,
oh, yeah.
You know, it was a nice crowd, but nothing crazy. Right. In between the innings of this no-hitter, they were going to live look-ins on the Jumbotron of the Panthers and the Flyers. So I'm not thinking anything early in the game. So boom, boom, boom. We get a big lead. I know early in the game I walked somebody and I hit Ellis Burks. And Larry Rothschild, who was a pitching coach, he took me underneath. And I love Larry. Love Larry.
Andres Galarraga. You walk Galarraga to start the inning.
Okay, Galarraga. Yeah, so I'm kind of doing my usual, like, walk, you know. And so Larry kind of jumps me. And I'm like, take it easy, man. Like, I got, you know, like, whatever. I don't know what I said, but something goofy. And that was, like, from the third inning on. And then it just started flowing. And this is going to sound like BS, but there wasn't anything that, you know, there's always a no-hitter where you go, oh, my God, you know, what a play. Or, oh, my God, something about it. It was about the most boring, benign no-hitter. I hate to say it. You know, just little pop-ups and broken bat this and that. So about halfway through the game, I think about the sixth inning, the Marlins people putting on this live look-in of the freaking Panthers playing the Flyers. They're like, wait a minute, we got a no-hitter here. We got to get people to, like, focusing back on our game. And, yeah, so the last – I always say this, and you know, certainly being on air, it was like, oh, you know, alert, 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 right. You know. Rich Cimino in San Diego's got a no-hitter at the fourth inning. I'm like, what?
Fifth inning. It's not happening.
No. Seventh inning. And I tell you why it's the seventh. If you get through the seventh, for a lot of reasons, now you need only six outs. But if you have a perfect game in the seventh inning, you're pitching to 1-2-3, right? You got the top three guys in a perfect game. If you walk a guy, you're pitching 2-3-4. If you walk two guys, you're pitching 3-4-5. So that was me. In the seventh inning, I pitched 3-4-5. You know, they had Colorado was good. What, that was 96. They came off a playoff team.
Oh, you're talking about Dante Bichette, Ellis Burks,
Vinny Castilla.
Big time lineup.
Yeah. It was Larry Walker too, right?
Yeah.
I think Larry Walker, I don't think he was in that
with
night.
The Expos still. He was still with the Expos, I think.
No, 95. Was he? Okay.
I'll pull it up. By the way, eighth inning, three pitches. Al, is that true?
How about that? Is that,
that's crazy?
Would you do that
in a 5-0 game there.
Or 11-0? Chinch, they started swinging at the first pitch.
That's crazy.
Oh my God, 11-0 the eighth.
So Eric Young is the last batter, and I'm like, and Charlie Johnson's in there. You know, I threw a lot of cutters, a bit less back then, but and I was like, no way, I'm going fastball away every time. If this dude goes right field, grounder, whatever, but. And it was just, and I don't know how many it was. He kept fouling him off, and then he swung through it. And
awesome.
I think, you know, it's weird because, like, again, the whole no hit thing. I never really thought. I mean, you dream about it, but I never thought like, oh yeah, I got no hit stuff today. Like never. Like no hit stuff today means what? You leave a ball up, and the guy pops it out. It's like, you know, it's. But once I did it. I'll be lying to you guys if I said, like, I didn't think, man, that would be cool if I do it again. And the main thing was is that I was so lame at the last out. Charlie comes out to me. He hugs me. I hung him.
Oh, he just shook everybody's hand.
Like, if you didn't know any better, you would have figured it was, like, a dude who just threw, like, a shutout, gave up, like, one or two runs.
funny.
I didn't know what to do. I said, man, if I ever throw another no hitter, man, I wish I would. I'd go nuts.
I'm going nuts, yeah.
Well, at least your kid did it for you, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So 97, brother, I think, you know, you talk about that 93 team in Toronto, man, where you loaded. 97 in Florida. Let's go down just for a second. Charles Johnson, Jeff Conine, Craig Council, Renteria, Gary Sheffield, Moise Salou, Devon White, Bobby Bonilla. Then you had Kevin Brown, you, Alex Hernandez, LeVon Hernandez, and Rob Nen closing, who was filthy. Ridiculous. Right, who was filthy. Dude, take us back to that team and, you know, what that was like. And also, when it was all said and done against the Indians, Jim Leland, my favorite manager of all time, one of the best managers in the history of the game, hands Al Leiter the ball to take for game seven. Just take us through, especially that run. What was it like getting the ball for game seven and that team, you know, walking it off in Florida and the pandemonium that ensued?
Amazing. And I'm going to throw in, I can't believe I say the late Darren Dalton, but we traded for Dutch at the trade deadline. And he was the kind of the final elixir to team chemistry. Not that we had a bad problem, but like he was a dude. Like, I don't know if you ever encountered with Darren Dalton.
Yeah, I did. It's an awesome guy.
Yeah. And like the presence was like, we needed this. It was a weird quandary. We're up 3-2. Our ace is on the mound. I'm charting because I'm going to pitch if there is a game seven. Kevin Brown, who was amazing, just amazing. Like every game seemed like he was either a shutout or almost a shutout. And their fourth starter, I guess, I don't know, Chad O'J, nice pitcher, really good sinker. Yep. And he shoves. Like I think Brownie gave up a couple, you know, we didn't score. But I'm sitting there, I'm like, I was fighting myself because I'm charting. And I'm like, you know, I'm looking and like thinking like there's a game tomorrow. But then part of me, I was like, I hope there isn't a game. But then there was a piece of me saying, man, wouldn't that be pretty cool? Pitch a game seven? Like just doesn't happen that much.
Oh, it's conflicting.
But then I'm like, no, I don't want to pitch a game seven because I want to go jump on a dog pile and not worry about that, you know, the headache and pressure of it. So when we lost, I completely got into like, okay, you know, game mode. I gotta do my thing. And one of the things I did was I looked at my game four and typical, like my crappy games were spraying the ball, walking some dudes, you know, here comes like a ball up in the zone, a guy hits a double, you score three, you know, two guys on base, you walk like that, you know, that's your tempo. You, even now we watch a game, like if a guy has a bad game, there's always like two soft spots in the lineup where you just kind of lose it. That was me. But I looked at two guys in the, I guess it was their LCS, or maybe it was their division series, Andy Pettit and David Wells. Mm. Andy Pettit got hit around by the Indians, and the Indians, they had a hell of a lineup that year.
Loaded.
Sandy was the MVP. I got called up
to that team in 97. I got sent out to the Arizona Fall League, but I was on that team in September, and they were loaded.
Yeah, that was
a hell of a lineup. I mean, there was no soft spot.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know. I guess Vizcal batting eighth, I guess, or ninth, or whatever.
But he was still really good. Almost had 3,000 hits. Yeah.
You know? Actually, he led off. What am I talking about here? So, I looked at both of them, and I said, in order for me to not crap the bed, I gotta do something different. And I was, you know, power fastball, power slider, power cutter, occasional backdoor curveball, very occasional changeup. And I was like, I need to do something different. So I told Larry Rothschild, I said, first pitch of the game is gonna be a curveball. I need to establish I'm throwing freaking curveballs and I'm throwing a bunch of them because these guys are gonna be on me. So Larry's like, well, we'll look at the lineup. I was like, no, I don't give a shit who's up. Nice. I'm throwing first pitch of the game curveball because I need my own brain to say, get that out. You're going to need it. So I'm warming up. I get to my curveball. We're down the right field line at Pro Player Stadium. And I literally bounced almost every curveball. They had a rubber tarp. I don't know if you knew this case, but they had like rubber on the ground. And it kept skipping up into the stands. Like I threw like nine balls into the stands while I'm warming up. First pitch of the game, Eddie Montague's behind the plate. Omar Vizquel, Charlie Johnson, boom. And I'm telling you, it was like one of those perfect little boom. And Eddie Monty goes, drag. And I'm telling you, there's seven. They peeled off every tarp at that stadium. There was like, I don't know, it felt like 105,000, but there was a ton of people there. I don't know what the attendance was, Chinch, but it was a lot. And it was like, it was, Case, I'm telling you, it was like one of those, oh, okay. And I brought it out, and I remember throwing a bunch to Dave Justice and a bunch to Matt Williams and Manny Ramirez. Like,
wait, real quick, 67,204 people in that game.
It was bananas, man. I mean, if they could have put any more in there, yeah, because well, they have to peel the stands back in left field, so they would have put. Yeah, it was crazy, and yeah, it was just like one of those things, man. I keep making pitches, and you're right, Leland. You know, gave me the ball. I mean, it was my day, but because I wasn't great in game three, you know, there was. That
where,
you know,
where were you when Renteria got the hit?
When dugout,
were you in the dugout? Wow,
oh, yeah, no, that's not you're not going inside to you know, ice it down and have a couple of beers. Well, I might have had a couple of beers, but
in the dugout,
yeah, next to Skip with his cigarette.
You feel like you're at a bar in New York at 2 a.m. with Skip smoking heaters, you're having a couple of beers, but you're watching a big league game. Oh my God, dude! That what a moment that must have been for you. But as you fast forward, they blow up that team. Wade Huizenga says we're gonna have a fire sale. We're getting rid of everybody. Everyone from that team goes. Dave Dombrowski's wheeling, dealing people. You end up with the Mets. Yeah. You end up back home. You end up with the team that you and your dad and your family rooted for growing up, and now you're back home. What did that mean to you to go back to New York, especially for the Mets?
Amazing to the team. You rooted for, and I still had plenty left in the tank. I, what year, how old was I? 30? Is I 30 yet? How old was I? 87.
Yeah, it was 98.
98. So I'm like 33?
Yep.
32? I thought it was pretty cool. So Dave Dombrowski calls me, and we knew they were unloading everybody, right? So he calls me, goes, look, I'm not promising you anything. He said, but I have two comparable deals.
32.
Do you have a preference? What? How old was I?
32. Yeah.
32.
So, yeah, there it is, 32. A year before I pitched against you, Case, and it should have given you 99,000 RBIs. So he says, I'm not promising you, but I have comparable deals, St. Louis Cardinals or the New York Mets. This was Dave Dombrowski. And I was like, you know, Case, that's pretty cool. When a, you know, the GM's calling you, he doesn't do that. Like, you know,
that's awesome of him to do that.
So I said, Dave, I said, man, I mean, I grew up a Mets fan. Like, I that would be amazing. You know, and it's in division. Like, you know, whatever. Although the Marlins, you know, really went the other way for a few years because of that. And sure enough, man, next day, AJ Burnett was a A-ball pitcher with the Mets. That went over in that trade.
I didn't know that. That was the AJ Burnett went over in that trade. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. AJ Burnett. There was I don't know, about four or five guys. Yeah. So that was, you know, I guess you're a Pittsburgh. Were you a Pirate fan?
Yeah. It's a huge Pirate fan. Huge Pirate fan.
Yeah. So it'd be.
Yeah. I played for Pittsburgh in 06 for a little bit, but it meant a lot to play there. It's like your dream, you know, your dream team as a kid. So. Totally. You know, for you with the Mets, but you went there, brother. And not only did you go there,
dominated.
You end up dominating 17-6 with a 2.47, and now the Mets are second in the NL East, 88-74. You know, and then you end up, you know, oh, and Mike Piazza ends up coming. This is where I want to talk about him a little bit because, you know, I not playing for the Mets. I've heard different things about Piazza as a teammate. You know, maybe he was a little moody, played with guys that come in. They're like, don't talk to him today. He's a little moody. I'm like, all right, that's so tired. But, you know what I mean? I've heard different things about Piazza, but I know, you know, my relationship with you, I know you and Mike are friends, and you always had great things to say about Mike Piazza. Can you talk about him a little bit and just the figure he was in New York? You know, almost seemed like a cartoon figure. But more importantly, what was he like as a teammate?
Yeah. So, look, I appreciate it more after you play to realize the guys that took it so seriously, maybe to a detriment, and I don't know, maybe Mike would agree, would admit to it or not, but after the fact, when you get a guy that's so lasered locked in, and being a catcher is more responsibility than in this essence of winning that game and the responsibility than even a starting pitcher, because you're dealing with an entire staff. You're dealing with you, you know, controlling behind the plate. And then he happened to be our best player. So now you become your best offensive player. It's a really odd, you know, how many teams have you ever played on where your catcher was your superstar best player?
Right.
I mean, maybe.
Good point.
Pudge. I played with Pudge a little bit, but he was
okay. Pudge,
one of the best players. Yeah.
Maybe Posey. I don't know. Yeah. You know,
not
me. But not to Mike's desk. So like he took that responsibility to a whole other level. So I think when teammates or people or peripheral people, you know, didn't identify like this, the how much he really took. You know, really took on. A bad game, a good game, you know, a loss, a win. I lockered next to him for 7 years. Like we were right here, right next to each other. And, you know, he was a good teammate. He cared. Like you talk about high level of give a shit. Yeah. So we would drive back to the city too. Like, you know, cause I would either, we'd carpool cause he lived near me on the Upper East Side on, you know, so I got to know him in a good way. And, you know, there was nobody, I would say this, and I played on good teams. We went through it, right? Toronto and the Marlins with the World Series teams. No, none of my teammates represented the as important of a player as Mike Piazza.
Wow.
In all my years. And I say that not because of the other Hall of Fame guys that I played with, but it was about Mike. And yeah, we had nice players around. Todd Zeal was a nice player. Robin Ventura was a nice player. John Olerud was a nice player. But Mike was like, he was rock star status.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you talk about the ultimate target on his back. And now it's like every night, every day, and the microphone in front of his face. And like, you know, he dealt like, so, you know, Case, you would have liked him. You would have liked him. He knew when to let his hair down. He knew when the right off day to be able to go and, you know, we'd go to karaoke and he liked like hair band stuff and like Def Leppard and like some crazy nice. Metallica. The stuff you liked, actually. Yeah. Yeah, he was so into the heavy metal stuff. So, you know, and I appreciated that. You know, and he gave a shit.
Yeah. Yeah, I love playing against him. I love how hard he played. He played. I remember talking to him at first base a couple of times. I'm like, man, I.
Case, you're a big dude. You're a big dude, and you got big hands, big forearms. I'm telling you, and I'm not lying. He would take his fist, right hand, and punch cement walls. And I'm not talking about like a, like, boom.
Oh my
God. Look, I'm like, oh my God, what's he doing? He's out of his mind. I'm serious. And I'm like, Mike, stop. And like, he would, like, you know, he got knuckles that like kind of protrude a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, he had like flat, like what? Stop.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So for you and Piazza and all the boys, all that whole, that those teams, those Mets teams that now are really good. What was that Subway Series like in 2000? You guys versus the Yankees, you know, I remember watching it as a fan and saying, boy, that atmosphere is intense, it seems like.
Yeah. So amazing. Now back to, I start with the Yankees. I'm on the back nine of my career. You know, I'm with the team that I rooted for as a kid. We beat the Cardinals in five.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, five. And we were waiting to find out whether we were going to Seattle or playing the Yankees. And I was 100%. I'm like, are you kidding me? I don't care the mighty Yanks or not. I so want to play the Yankees.
Yeah.
It was like 40-something years since the last real Subway Series when the Dodgers played the Yankees in the 40s or 57 or whatever the hell year that was, Chinch. So I was like all in. I'm like, yeah. And I embraced it, man. We were the little engine that could. If you look at our roster compared to the Yankee roster and their brand names and our brand names, like, you know, we didn't compare, but we won because of the collective unit. Like, and I say this all the time, and it pisses me off when people who've never played debunk team chemistry.
Right. I
never
hate
played
that.
On a team.
Joke. I hate that. It totally matters.
You've never played on a team. I want Sean Casey and Rich Cinciamino and all my teammates to feel awesome. I want them to get in their cars and they can't wait to get to the field and there's no head trash and there's no bullshit and they're happy to be there and they're pulling all on the same side of the rope and all that stuff, that cliche thing.
Yeah,
another book. Here's another book that I read.
John Wooden.
John Wooden is that you talk about team. So we had that. We had that with our club.
Yeah,
so,
I've heard just as many stories you tell about Todd Pratt as you've told about Mike Piazza. Like you had that much of a group where you guys were all kind of equals in some ways.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, not only Johnny Franco, but Matt Franco and Joe McEwing and Vance Wilson and like dudes that like weren't our everyday guys. Like you talk about like fight for each other.
Yeah.
You know, hanging out.
Those teams were legit and driven by, it seemed like, in Piazza in that lineup. I want to go back to that next year. After the Subway Series in 2000, 2001. Because obviously our whole country, the whole world was hit hard at 9/11 when the towers were hit. And then baseball was canceled for a couple of weeks. We were in Chicago with the Reds at the time. We bussed home. But when baseball came back, you guys with the Mets and Piazza hitting that home run to win the game back when you guys first came back, and you also came out wearing the fire department and the NYPD hats. Can you take us back to why did you end up wearing those hats? And what was it like coming back in New York City, in Shea Stadium, and even the night when Piazza homered?
Yeah. So for all of us, right? But we were at ground zero as far as the first big public event where a lot of people were convening. You know, the quandary for me was that at the time leading up to the game, baseball seemed so irrelevant. And the fact that living in Manhattan and literally being around, a couple miles uptown from where it happened, it really felt weird to prepare for a baseball game. You know, with knowing that people, not only the loved ones and the people who died, but the people who are feeling the pain. But once they realize, we're going to go ahead and play, we're going to do this. The concern was, are we safe? Once we established and we had federal agents and NYPD and unbelievable level of security, so we knew we were safe. And then once the game and the pageantry played out, and you mentioned a case with Mike, our hero, our star, hits a big home run that wins the game against our ultimate nemesis, the Braves, like total thorn in our side and badass organization, unbelievable team. You know, it made me realize as I drove home late that night that we were 100% doing the right thing because there were so many people that were feeling the pain and trying to heal. And it sounds cliche, but we were totally a distraction for many people to get away from it.
Well, plus you couldn't change your channel. There was nothing other than that on television. That game you guys played was maybe the very first thing where it's like, it just wasn't, it was about something else happening on television. Yeah. I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. It was not only New York, but it was national, right? I mean, we were it was a big event. But I think how we all felt, right? I mean, we all have our story about where we were and you know our emotions and all that. And the gamut for me was scared, nervous, sad, mad, pissed off to all of it of what transpired. But I knew after we played that it was clearly the right thing for us to move forward and try to help heal. And we, it was daily. Every time we got to the field, tried to get there early enough, get my work in, and then go over to the staging area. And we were packing a lot of boxes and supplies and all that. Cause it was behind home plate at the old Shea Stadium, there was a big area where just endless trucks, supplies going down to Ground Zero. And, you know, how could you not think about that, right? You immediately go to the people that were lost. You're thinking about widows and loved ones and little kids and all that. And like, you know, then we go back to behind the Diamond Club and go into the clubhouse and we're going to play a game that night. It was just like, you know, it was rough. It was.
I feel like you said, though, I really feel like it mattered. It mattered that baseball was back, some sense of normalcy for our country. But I just know as a fan, you know, watching when it came back, when President Bush throws out the first pitch in Yankee Stadium, when Piazza hits that home run in Shea, for all of us, because New York was was where it was all happening. For all of us, you know, those are very healing moments for our country. When you guys came back and did that. So I just, you know, kudos to
absolutely that
time. So Al, you know, you fast forward out, you know, you end up having what an unbelievable journey you've had in the big leagues. You ended up with the Yankees. Can you just take us through that last time on the mound where you walked off and you knew, you know what, this is it. I'm done.
Well, I wanted to finish with the Mets. You know, but that didn't work out, whatever, you know, because there were certain numbers that I thought would be cool to be mentioned with some of the idols that I grew up, you know, in particular, Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, Dwight Gooden, but didn't work out. Signed with the Marlins. I was awful. 39 years old, turning 40. And Cashman, the Yankees, their pitching was, you know, really going sideways with injuries. And at the trade deadline, they traded for me. And, you know, I remember talking to Cash and I said, Cash, look, I have something left. Their pitching coach, you talk about full circle. I mentioned about Gil Patterson earlier, who was with the A's, who is now the AAA pitching coach, who's back with the Yankees.
Wow. No way.
And I said to Cash, let me go to Columbus. I've worked with Gil over the years. I love him. And, you know, let him straighten me out. And yeah, I got something left. Yeah. Good idea. So they're making all these plans for flights and all this other stuff. I get a call back from my agent, Alan Hendricks. He's like, well, hang tight. I don't know what's happening. Just hang tight. I don't know. You might not be going to Columbus. You might be going right to business. I'm like, all right. Yeah, great. They open up in Boston after the break. And then I get a call a little bit further later. It's Friday now. And they said, get up to New York, or get up. You got to get up Saturday to Boston because you're starting Sunday night.
Sunday night baseball. Red Sox Yankees. I'll never forget this game.
Red Sox Yankees. I'm telling you. So I'm like, all right, you know. I'm thinking like I can't get anybody out. You know, I'm doing. I feel terrible, but my ERA is 5. But okay, I'll figure it out. I get to Yankee State. No, I get to Boston. It's an afternoon game. I think Randy Johnson was pitching, and he wins. Pitched a great game. And I get to Boston, and it was like – I turned the radio on. It's like seventh inning or something. I couldn't even get to the stadium. So I go to the hotel. The next day, I get on the bus, as we do, right?
Yep.
I'm starting pitcher. I was with the Mets for 7 years, kind of the across town rival thing that all those guys, I know all the guys on the team, right? But I'm on the, and I basically introduced myself to my new teammates in that visiting the clubhouse at Fenway. You know how small it is.
Oh yeah.
And I remember being in the training room and Joe Torre comes in and he says, hello. And I say, you know, and I'm getting ready. And he said, so tell me how much you've been throwing. I said, I haven't been throwing much, Joe. Said, well, tell me what he's been throwing. I'm not kidding. I said, well, I've been playing catch with my son, Jack. He's 5 years old. Jack was 5. All-star break. You know, I, whatever. I like, and he turns around. He's like, oh, God. So Posada comes in. I tell Jorge, he's like, Jorge, I like my cutter. You know, I got to use my curveball. Whatever. We have like a quick scout report meeting. And I go out and I pitch well enough. We win the game. It's, you know, it was really a cool moment.
You pitched well enough. Al, you pitched that was one of the best regular season games of that year. Don't undersell what you did that
night. It was a good game. Yeah, it was cool. I was digging on it. It was like next level, like excitement. You know, I'm back, whatever. It was very, you're right, Chinch. It made my season. It did. I was,
yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it was cool.
Al, when you look back at your career now, you know, where you're at in your life now, what do you appreciate the most?
Well, the opportunity, but the opportunity to be a major leaguer, and appreciated all of what that meant. And really respected being a major leaguer. You know, I came up to the big leagues when the owner of the Yankees, George Steinbrenner, he wouldn't let anybody in the clubhouse. Like, clubhouses were meant for you earn to get right to a major league clubhouse. You know, nobody was there weren't people walking through the clubhouse. It was like major league staff, your GM, and like, you know, that's it. So I always appreciated that. But here, I'm gonna finish with this story because it totally put a bow on my whole baseball life. And I didn't cry but twice in baseball. And it was that game in game six of the 2000 World Series when I did pitch my heart out and Luis Ho hits a 13 hopper up the middle and we lose the World Series. But I gave everything I could. I really did. It was 143 pitches, whatever. We lose the game, but and I felt the exhaustion of everything I put into it. But then spring of 06, I was on the WBC. We lost to Japan in the semifinals, came back to the Yankees spring training. I went into Joe Torre and I said, Joe, thank you so much. I appreciate it, but I'm done. I'm 40. You know, they wanted to put me in the pen. I was just mentally, I was done. I lost the it, right? And I said, well, how do you want to do this? He's like, Joe is telling me. He's like, I don't know. I'm either sending guys down or I'm releasing them. Nobody retires in spring training. Fair enough. I said, but would you do me a favor? Because there's nothing wrong, and I still can throw. I said, would you give me a chance to pitch an inning today? So he's looking at it. Randy Johnson was starting. It was against Cleveland. And he said, I got to get at least Mo in there. And I think there was another reliever of one of his guys he had to get in. He said, but yeah. I should be able to get in an inning. Randy's mowing. Like, he's got like 40 pitches after five innings. I'm like, I'm sitting down in the bullpen. And they call down and they get me up. But before that, I told you about Gil Patterson, who I adore. Yeah. He is a pitching coach in the minor leagues. I called over to him and I said, hey, would you come over? I'm going to get a chance to pitch today. It's going to be my last game. He was like the only guy that I told that. Well, no. The pitching coach for the New York Yankees in 06 was Ron Guidry. Mm. The hitting coach was Don Mattingly. Huh. And I have Gil Patterson coming over, who was my first pitching coach in pro ball.
Wow.
And Joe Kerrigan is the bullpen coach. So I get up, I start warming up, it's in Tampa. And I'm telling you, guys, I tried to blow my arm out because I wanted to, like, at least justify it. Like, and I'm throwing, and I'm telling you, it was probably one of my best bullpens. And Joe Kerrigan, longtime pitcher coach, he's looking at me. He's like, you sure you want to retire? I'm like, yeah, I think so. And I'm telling you, Case, I'm like, I'm. It looks good. So I run in. I'm getting one out. And you know who the out is? Chinch, pull him up. Eduardo Perez.
Eduardo Perez. Gosh, Eduardo, yes.
And Eduardo crushes lefties and he crushes me.
Crushes lefties.
That is hysterical.
So I'm like, holy shit, my one batter is going to be Eduardo Perez and he takes me deep.
What did he do?
He grounded out to A-Rod on a little two-seam 91-mile-an-hour fastball away, which I don't normally throw. A-Rod throws it over to Giambi, and it was like kind of that picture that I showed you earlier, but it was because we had WBC, we had all the guys in the game the whole game because they were leaving to go start the season. It was late in spring. And Gator comes out to get me out, and Jeter's standing there, and A-Rod and Cano, and Guidry hugs me. And Jeter looks at me and goes, what's going on? And I'm like, I look at Derek. I'm like, I just retired. He looks at me. He's like, what?
Holy cow.
So they're all looking at me on the mound. I was like, really? It's like, it's kind of a dumb moment. It's like spring training and I'm retired, you know, like, but I didn't tell anybody. So I walk into the dugout and I sit down and, you know, it's like one of those, all right, this is it. I don't know what your last game was, Case, but, and I'm in Tampa, it's spring training, guys coming up, hey, you know, and they're kind of getting wind that like Al Leiter's retired. Gil Patterson comes over, he hugs me. And I kind of start losing it. Like my first year as an 18-year-old player in Oneonta, New York, my pitching coach was Gil Patterson. And here he is, you know, 23 years later, he's hugging me. Don Mattingly comes over, hugs me. He was my first baseman in my first game. Ron Guidry was a teammate. God. And then the I was drafted, this is where it like got me. The year I was drafted, Yogi Berra was the manager in 1984 of the Yankees. Yogi, because Yogi always was in spring training, he walked over and he hugged me.
Oh, my God.
I started losing. I'm like, wow. Oh, my God. Like, there was too many coincidences.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Like, so it was like this fast-forward train of 23 years, and it was all, like, right in front of me. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, wow, you know, man. It's like, you know, I didn't do much of anything for the Yankees, but it's so felt right. Yeah. Like this. Yeah.
It put perfect bookends onto an unbelievable career. It bookended your career. Came in with the Yankees as a guy, then gets traded and you end with the Yankees. You just bookended an amazing career, which is like, what an awesome story, man. That's so
awesome. It was cool.
Well, bro, I Chinson and I can't thank you enough, man, for coming on. You know, it's really so funny. When we were first getting this going, Al and I had a conversation, literally. I mean, I think we're 2-3 shows into it. I was in my kitchen and I was telling Al we're getting the mayor's office started. And you know, Al always has those good ideas. You know, we were kind of, you know, bouncing some ideas off each other. So, brother, to have you on, you know, at this stage of can't teach experience, we're getting a little better. But thanks, man. The journey of Al Leiter, the journey of what Jack Leiter is going to do is going to be fun to watch. And thank you for taking your time, brother. I will see you soon at the network at some point here.
Please. I'm just glad you finally asked me.
You want to make sure we were good enough.
We want to make sure we're good. Because if we weren't good, the first person that would tell us that we sucked is Al Leiter. But honestly, like, dude.
You guys are horseshit. You guys are horseshit.
All out of love, guys. All out of love.
Yeah. Al, you've been to me personally, you've been like a big brother. And for the people at home that don't understand, this man is so rich, he does not need to get out of bed in the morning, but he does, and he works extremely hard on everything he does, which is a testament to the human being he is, and I love you, man. I'm really, really psyched that you did this with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Really, guys. Really. Thank you, bro. I hope you blow this up, guys. Really. I see what's out there, and it could only get better and more refined and all of it.
Thanks, man.
Thanks. And one final thing that we didn't get to in the background is that Roberto Clemente Award. That was I know that was a huge thing for you. That's a big deal for anyone plays in the big leagues, get the Roberto Clemente Award. That means you're impacting the community and impact the people like you still are, Al. We love you, brother. And
Thank you.
We will see you soon, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Al.
See you, buddy.
See you.
Wow, Chinch. I've been waiting for that one for a long time. And, you know, one of the best dudes going, and what a heck of a player, man. In my opinion, one of the better lefties the game's ever seen.
Yeah. And
it just took him a little bit to get going. You know, all the injuries at the beginning, really didn't get hit his stride till 93 with the Blue Jays. Right. So, I mean, do the math, you know what I mean? Those first few years.
Totally. And to be
have a chance to put up the numbers.
Right. And to be a native New Jersey guy, so a tri-state area guy, like I have that poster up, you know, that was what, 22 years ago. That was, and like what that team did, and I grew up a Yankee fan, but I was always an Al Leiter fan just because he was from around here, and just because of the work ethic, you can tell the type of person he was. You know, like I say, I joke about how rich he is, but you talk about down to earth human being and somebody who actually works hard on everything he does. I mean that as a purpose, and he brought a lot back to his hometown that was gone. They had not made the playoffs in 11 years by the time he got to the Mets. Then he pretty much had a lot to do with taking them to the World Series. But again, like you said, he's always been a mentor to me and to people that get into the industry. And he is so – he'll make fun of you the day he meets you, But he'll treat you the same every way. And if you're a good person, he treats you good. And he's just, he is one of my favorite people I know. He's been like a big brother to me. He's put me in check sometimes because of that leadership role. And I've deserved it and needed it. And I'm sure like you and him have talked shop and how to do things and whatever. And I really care about that guy. And everybody, everything that you see on TV, folks, that's that man. It's him, flat out.
And he keeps it honest. You know, he keeps it real. Right. If he doesn't like something, he'll tell you about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, also, too, they can talk about his work ethic at the network. The demos that he does are so in-depth. They go into the mind of the pitcher and you know, sequencing and all that stuff. And he's won an Emmy doing it. So everything Al's done, he's succeeded in. It's just pretty cool to see. Yeah. It's going to be really fun to see Jack Leiter.
Really cool to see Jack Leiter. He looks like a nice, handsome, young Al Leiter out there on a mound. It'd be fun to see his career develop. All right, man. Another great one. You're the best.
Man. All right, Gigi. Awesome, man. Awesome. And for everyone out there, man, go hit the follow us at the mayor's office and go download, subscribe, do all those things. But we're grateful you guys are joining us and have a grateful day. Gigi, I love you, brother.
Love you, buddy.
I will see you next week.
All right.